Hey, it's Canzano. I appreciate you listening to the podcast. Make sure you subscribe and give us some feedback. Also, the Bald-Faced Truth podcast, it's brought to you by Shoe Mill, my favorite shoe store with locations in Portland and Salem and online at shoemill.com. Shoe Mill, where we put the world at your feet.
Initialize sequence.
Welcome to the Baldcast, a production of John Canzano's Bald-Faced Truth. BFFT. Live from the home studios presented by High Caliber Millwrights, here's John Canzano with the bald-faced truth.
Stephen Ortiz is a professor of sociology at Oregon State. He's written a book. A book that caught my attention when it crossed my radar. And I think you'll be into it, too. It's called The Sport Marriage. It's about survival. It's about sacrifice. It's about the ultimate team players. And if you're somebody out there that has often watched sporting events and you'll see the camera cut to the spouse who's in the stands, you go, oh, look, there's the spouse. We don't often think about their world, their experience. Stephen Ortiz has made it a study. Professor at Oregon State joining us now. I appreciate you, Stephen Ortiz. Appreciate what you are doing here. Where did you get the idea for this book?
Oh, that's a really good question. I was a grad student working on my second master's thesis. And at that time, my main interest was in some of the occupational stressors that male pro athletes have to deal with in their careers. And as I was getting into that topic and doing some research, it was brought to my attention that, hey, the public knows a lot about these guys. Why don't you study something that the public has less knowledge of, which is their families and their marriages? And so I gave that quite a bit of thought and decided to go ahead and do it. And so I did interview a number of wives, husbands in the NFL, and there was so much more that they wanted to discuss that I was prepared for. And so I thought, well, maybe once I have this written up and turned in, when I move on, maybe this is something I'll return to and research in more depth, which is what I did. And there were so many stories that these women wanted to share that I thought, well, maybe when I get further along in my career, I'll have an opportunity to increase the scope of my previous research. And the more I listened to these particular women, I thought somebody's got to share these stories. Somebody has got to do research because these are relatively invisible women. Their voices have been silent for so long, and we only know anything about them from stereotypes, all these prevailing stereotypes, radio, on reality programs and movies and so on.
You know, it's interesting because I thought about this at the beginning of the pandemic as we saw players in sports having to make decisions between loyalty to their team that they're paid by and loyalty to their family. There is a loyalty issue that is almost triangular there that is in play here. How does that work when, because often what's right for the team is not right for the family?
That's another really good question. I think when I look back on the research that I've done, the one thing that really stands out that characterizes the sport marriage, and we're talking about heteronormative, heterosexual sport marriages, is what I'm calling a career-dominated work-family model. And in this career-dominated marriage, the husband's career always comes first. It's a priority in the marriage. Everything else is secondary. And so you have a situation where the wives defer to the husband's career. She will do all she can to support the career. And career success is all important because it validates all of her sacrifice, all of her support, everything that she puts into this particular kind of relationship. And so if he achieves success, then it's a positive validation of everything that she puts into the marriage. So she is not going to do anything that would disrupt or destabilize the relationship. And that's part of this career-dominated marriage idea, is the fact that these women follow what I would call an unwritten book of rules, the do's and don'ts in marriages to male pro athletes. And so there are just certain things you don't do as a wife in public life. And this represents so many normalized rules that these women have internalized, that these women have normalized, and that these women follow, and their husbands expect their wives to follow this rule book.
The Sport of Marriage, written by Stephen Ortiz, professor at Oregon State. Stephen, give us an example of kind of some of those unwritten rules that they're expected to follow and how they sort of accept that. And, you know, obviously, I think it's a fantastic study.
Well, thank you. One rule is never do anything in public that could reflect negatively on the husband's celebrityhood, his image, or the team's image. And so the women learn to bite their tongue when they get angry. They learn to grin and bear it, so they suppress all the time in public life. Their anger, their frustration, typical stories revolve around female groupies that make advances to their husbands in public situations right in front of the wife. And so the wife will suppress her anger at this inappropriate behavior and smile as if she's not affected by these kinds of advances. And that gets old after a while. If your husband is fortunate to have a lengthy career, that's many years of suppressing all the time. And so this makes for angry women and women who are frustrated because their husbands really don't discourage this kind of female interest in them in public situations.
It's interesting. Go ahead.
Mm-hmm. No, go ahead.
Do you find the same, or did you look at maybe when the athlete might be a female athlete who is successful? Do you find the same dynamic to exist in a marriage or a relationship where it's the roles are reversed gender wise?
I have not run across any research, and I have not conducted any research that looks at the sport marriage of men who are married to female professional athletes. I would say, though, that if this career-dominated model is in place, then I don't think we're going to see a lot of gender differences. But, again, because we live in a patriarchal society that includes many different types of patriarchies, then this could be not as extensive in that particular role reversal as in the traditional where you have women married to male pro athletes.
Stephen Ortiz is our guest, professor at Oregon State. You deal a lot with family, sociology, work-life balance. That is a topic that comes up all the time on this show, and I talk about it incessantly. I'm doing this radio show from my home studio. I've got three kids. I know my job doesn't love me. I know I'm not going to be on my deathbed saying, I wish I would have worked one more day. You know, what have you found in your time as a professor? Is this becoming a bigger topic, or am I just at an age where I'm recognizing it more?
Well, I think if we're discussing a two-paycheck family, then partners have to in some way come to some kind of an agreement about how do we balance the demands of work in terms of our families. In the career-dominated marriage, you have women who are trying to manage the what we call work spillover into family life. And there is no dividing line in trying to manage that spillover because work and family become blurred. Those boundaries are blurred. And so these women are trying to manage the spillover. And again, there are certain husbands in my research that I described in my book as workaholic men. And the thing about being a workaholic in our society, generally it's okay because we live in a capitalistic society. So, you know, this is, you know, having the right work ethic and things like that. In the world of sports, having the right work ethic is important, and that's often expressed in terms of being disciplined or having the right dedication to the game. So the athlete's workaholic approach to their careers is not really questioned. In many ways, It's expected, because if you don't have the right attitude, you're not one of us, and you're not going to get very far in your career. So if, as long as a career-dominated marriage, as long as that work-family model is in place, it will be very challenging for couples to develop those kinds of boundaries where there is some kind of realistic balance between the demands of work and the demands of family.
How much cooperation did you get from the women who are married to or in relationships with high-profile athletes? Were they by and large eager to talk about it, or were they a little nervous given the, you know, the sort of the unspoken rules you talked about?
Well, gaining access to the participants in the study was extremely challenging. And again, this is a longitudinal study. So I did the first study in 1989 through 93. And the front office protects the players and their families, so it's difficult to gain access that way. You can't gain access through other ways. So I basically did a mail out at the time to see what the response would be. And so you had two kinds of gatekeepers that made it very problematic initially, and that was the front office of the team and the husbands themselves. But once I was able to gain access, the women were cooperated as much as possible, above and beyond my expectations, very anxious to talk about issues in their marriages, because every time they would reach out because of issues they had to deal with, they were often criticized. They were often told, "What are you complaining about? I wish I was you. Your husband's making $1 million. You've got three beautiful children. You know, you live in this beautiful home. I wish I was you." So then the wives learn not to reach out. Even family members aren't understanding of their situation. So these women are generally isolated from everything else. And even though they provide so much emotional support and esteem support, they get very little support in return from their career-absorbed, career-driven husbands, whose focus is mainly on their careers. And this is one reason why, in the book, I describe why they married certain women, because they'll date certain women, but they'll marry other women, women who are strong and resilient, intelligent, because that way the men can focus solely on their careers and build their careers and to try to achieve success in their careers, because they're married to women who are strong. They're going to take care of domestic life, you know. And MLB, for example, husband doesn't want to get a call in the dugout during the game with his wife saying, "Little Johnny just fell down and scraped his knee. What do I do?" You know, so these are very capable women, and these are the kinds of women these men are drawn to.
What advice would you give? Because you've studied this, you know, you have some women who are in relationships with athletes that they knew were stars when they met them. You have others they may meet in college and not quite know what they're getting into. Is there some advice, like, you know, if you could give that advice to women who are engaged or in relationships with potential star athletes, of some things they might want to be mindful of?
Actually, the wives, I asked them in the second study, which took place a few years ago, which was a follow-up study, and I asked the participants in that study over the years, would they have some advice that they could share with other women who might be thinking about marriage to a pro athlete? And so they said, "Oh, yeah, I think we can offer a few tips." I said, "Okay." First of all, they said that women should carefully consider marriage to a professional athlete, because the sport marriage isn't for every woman. They also suggested that women have to learn as much as possible about his career, so that they're not getting secondhand information from the husband or his agent or the team organization. They also said that the motivation to marry a pro athlete should not include the expectation that it will be a glamorous lifestyle. It will be an affluent lifestyle. They suggested that if the husband is already on the team, she should make arrangements to meet with some of the wives on the team, spend time with them, find out what's in store for her. The other issue that came up that they were very strong feelings about is that a woman in a sport marriage must have her own identity. and make every attempt to maintain it. Because one of the characteristics that I discovered about the sport marriage as a career-dominated marriage is that many of the wives have what we call a wife of identity. So it's the wife of such and such a player, the wife of such and such a player. So she has no identity apart from her husband. And this is clearly evident in team functions, in public situations involving fan day. You know, one wife told me, she was approached and said, so who are you married to? Who do you belong to? So that's a very important issue, is to maintain your own identity apart from your husband. It's not uncommon, I talk about in one of the chapters, for wives to be approached after it's been determined that they are married to so-and-so. And because they can't reach the husband, they'll ask the wife for her autograph, which brings about a pattern that I identified as being a quasi-celebrity in the eyes of sport fans. So she's the next best thing since they can't get the autograph of the husband. She also has to understand that the husband's career, his career will be first in the marriage. That's going to be the priority. And she has to learn to accept that in some way, because trying to change him is not always going to be practical. So I can go on and on. There are a lot of them in the concluding chapter. And I thought it was important to pass on the advice that of the years that these women, you know, I think of them as survivors, have survived these marriages. I even in the book refer to them as the marriage workers, because the husbands work on their careers, but it's the wives who work on the marriages, not the husbands.
Stephen Ortiz, professor of sociology, Oregon State. Terrific job on the book. I encourage people to check it out. Stephen, where can they get the book, The Sport Marriage?
It just came out. I think you can probably, the best way to get a hold of it would be online.
It's The Sport Marriage by Stephen Ortiz. I appreciate you joining us. Thank you, Professor Ortiz.
Well, thank you for the opportunity to talk about my book. I appreciate it very much.
There he is, Stephen Ortiz. The book is called The Sport Marriage. Our 2 at 2 coming up. Anna will pop into the studio. I have so much more to talk about. You got the bald-faced truth statewide. What a show. Adriana's got her hands full now. Gabriel Sewell was on the show. Panay Sewell's dad. Noah Sewell's dad. AJ McCord of Coin was on the show. Producer of HBO's Hard Knocks, the producer and director, Shannon Furman was on the show. Professor Stephen Ortiz was on the show. It's like, it's not often we have that many guests on the show. Adriana, you holding up okay? A lot of podcasting today.
Yeah, I don't know why you say I'm getting busy now, because I've been busy.
I know.
Barely breathing back here.
I'm sorry. And I know, even with Shannon Furman, she was late. So you were scrambling around, getting phone numbers, getting a hold of her, going, what the heck, are you coming on or not? And you did a good job.
Thank you. I actually enjoy the pace, like not every day, but you know, it definitely makes it go by quickly.
Yeah, I looked up and I'm like, oh wow, Anna's here. Anna, welcome.
She's like one of those Chinese acrobats that is on a unicycle and then balancing, like spinning the plates, trying not to get the plates not to fall.
Yeah, how come you never do that? Is that something that all, like, why is that acrobat always Chinese?
My God,
that acrobat, no, the
really just asked me that.
The acrobat is always Chinese.
Why don't you do that?
Yeah,
because I'm Chinese.
How come you don't ride a unicycle?
Wow.
No, I'm serious. Why is that person always Chinese?
I swear, sometimes I think you married me just so you could say crap like that.
Look, I'm just saying, you said Chinese acrobat, and I went, you know what's interesting?
Yeah.
You never see that person who's balancing the bowls on their head riding the unicycle at the NBA game. It's never anybody but somebody who's Chinese.
Probably because in China, they like handpick someone at the age of three, decide that that's going to be their talent, and then send them away to a school where they train for that 12 hours a day until they become a professional at it, and then they make them go around the world.
They never look really happy.
No.
That person,
I've
seen
it. Mask of a smile.
They don't look happy. They look like they're out there working.
why don't you do that?
Here's the bottom line, though, too. Let's talk about Chinese culture for a second.
Uh-huh.
In Beijing, we wandered into a video store. Not a big comedy section in the Chinese store.
Okay, yeah.
Why doesn't that culture laugh more?
Oh, yeah. There's like, there until like maybe 5 years ago, there was no such thing as like a Chinese like happy funny sitcom. I don't know.
Why?
They're really into like sacrifice and, you know, suffering and drama.
Even your mom, she came and she was watching some series called The Red Lantern. Remember that?
Yeah.
It was just horrific.
No, that was a movie.
Was it a movie?
Wasn't it? And it was horrific.
It was. It was everything that could go wrong went wrong.
Really dark.
Destruction.
Yeah. It's not a cheery culture.
Yeah, I also think everything okay?
Mm-hmm.
All right.
Yeah.
We dropped everything here,
Peter.
Yeah,
you just settle down, would you?
Peter,
settle
the entire console just tipped over onto the ground, but we're okay.
he almost single-handedly hosed his own show.
Yeah, I tried, but but let's talk about, there has to be a reason. Is it that, because when you look at culture of China, it's Japanese and Chinese that were at odds. There was invasion, right? I mean, and then you talk about communism, and then you talk, I mean, these aren't happy themes.
It's never exactly been a cheerful, happy-go-lucky place to live. I mean, most of the country is still third world. You have like Shanghai and portions of it that are super like metropolis and modern. And overpopulated, but it's just it's most of the country has lived in poverty and in turmoil for most of its history, you know, throughout different dynasties and whatnot. So
now my friends are all texting me saying, I saw somebody on a unicycle, it's a long-haired guy. I get it. I'm not saying that. I'm saying at the NBA games, the acrobat, they even say Chinese acrobat.
Yeah,
that's a thing.
Well,
that's a brand.
Is it?
I think it is.
Are you like TMing it right now?
No, I'm just saying. But I'm not. I'm just saying. I'm pointing out a fact. Like, I don't see like Peter Sampson with bulls on his head riding a unicycle. It's always a Chinese woman who's doing that.
Uh-huh.
Were you surprised when we went to Beijing? I noticed you were asking a lot of questions of the people there, and you speak Mandarin, so you were able to communicate.
Yeah.
Were you surprised that...
I was surprised by a lot of things.
Okay, but... let's talk about that. What were you surprised by then?
I was surprised. Look, I know it's an oppressed country. I know that they, you know, a lot of the country doesn't even know that Tiananmen Square happened. They can't Google stuff. It just doesn't show up. It's like it never happened and doesn't exist. I understand that. So it's still just incredibly jarring for me as an American citizen who was born in Taiwan, which... thank God is democratic, sort of. They at least elect their own president and representatives. It's jarring to go to a country where you're talking to people and like the taxi cab driver literally thought there had been one murder in the entire city of Beijing for the previous year and was touting that as like, look at you messed up Americans. Look at how chaotic your lifestyle is. Life is so much better for us here. Saying that with such conviction... that you clearly he hadn't heard anything to the contrary.
He believed it.
It's like that nationalism, but with like a really myopic view.
Why did the average Chinese citizen during the Beijing Olympics root for Michael Phelps? Because, you know, I think I would have expected they would root against Michael Phelps.
No, they wanted their Beijing Olympics to matter. They wanted it to stand out, and he was one of their best choices, one of the best options of, you know, making that particular Olympics in their country special. It was going to be a highlight. that was would they be talked about for years to
greatness.
Come.
The greatness.
They wanted greatness.
Greatest Olympics.
Yes.
And
I mean, like, literally, the Chinese translation for the word China is Zhongguo, which means center of the world. Think about that. That's how they think of themselves, center of the world.
That's what it means.
Yeah, Zhongguo, like center and then world.
What were they yelling at the events, too? Because they had a rally cry. And I know in the Australia Olympics, it was Aussie, 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 oi, oi, oi. They would do that. But what were they yelling at the Chinese Olympics?
They yell
like, step
a phrase,
on the gas. What was that thing?
Yeah, it's like, jiayou. And the literal translation is, you know, add gasoline, step on the gas.
Pour some gas on it. Can you imagine? Peter Sampson, you're at a Blazer game. Damian Lillard's bringing the ball down the court, and you yell, throw some gas on it!
Hey, man, you don't know that I haven't done that.
And that would be the rally cry.
Well, considering the Chinese, you know, influence on the NBA, we might hear more of that.
I tell you that, I wasn't surprised at that, because we went by playgrounds in Beijing, and the kids on the playgrounds all had those NBA jerseys on.
Yeah.
There was like 40 different jerseys.
Uh-huh.
Kids, it was like the United Colors of the NBA jerseys out on the courts.
Yeah.
It was everything from the Sonics to the Blazers to the Lakers. And Kobe and Yao Ming, probably the two biggest stars at that time.
They were, but what was really trippy is that I would talk to like my relatives in Taiwan, and they knew intricate details about the Trailblazers, like players that were coming off the bench. I mean, they would say their names in broken English, but they knew their names.
They knew the Blazers
they were
better
watching
than people.
The games.
Yeah, here.
Yeah.
The NBA is not dumb.
That was eye-opening.
Market itself nationally. We also talked to young people, and it made me sad for some of the young people in that country because they were living like, they were like 20-year-old kids. It would be like the equivalent of Alabama and Adriana. They were living like five or six of them to a one-bedroom apartment. They were essentially making like way under market wages.
Uh-huh.
They're in the city of Beijing, working 10 or 12 hours a day just to do like spinning in a circle.
Yeah.
It was demoralizing.
Yeah, but that's what they're doing to try and get ahead. And, you know, we'll see. We'll see what happens with China in the next two decades or so.
You learned Mandarin. Who made you learn Mandarin? Because you came over to this country at age two.
I learned Mandarin on my own because it's what we spoke at home. So I actually spoke with a Chinese accent when I first started speaking English. And then my mom, who had been a Chinese literature and history teacher in Taiwan, created lesson plans for me. So when I was growing up, I'd have to do Chinese homework and my normal American homework. Let me tell you, that was a blast.
You had a lot of fun?
Yeah.
After school?
Yeah.
Long sessions
yeah.
of just hanging out, doing
well,
nothing?
In particular, because if you're learning to write Chinese, the only way that you learn to write it is just writing the same symbol over and over. It's just memory. Because when you have that many characters, you just have to write the same character like hundreds of times. Have a 9-year-old do that. Like, get our kids to do that?
Our kids will last 90 seconds. We'll talk parenting. We'll talk Vin Scully, who's on Twitter. We'll talk about that, plus a guy with...
We interrupt this broadcast with a special announcement from the Bald-Faced
Truth. Hey, sorry to interrupt the podcast, but if you want to listen to more of the Bald-Faced Truth radio show, including more of this segment that you're listening to, make sure you subscribe on SoundCloud and iTunes to the Bald-Faced Truth radio show. Thanks for listening.